Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Dr. Manjit Almadiris is a world authority on osseointegration surgery, which integrates artificial limbs into the bodies of amputees. But not so long ago, he was an asylum seeker, having escaped from Iraq after refusing to cut off the ears of deserters from Saddam Hussein's army. He then ended up on a boat heading for Christmas Island, then to Curtin Detention Centre, and at one stage even stood before an Australian court facing charges of inciting a riot. Dr. Madeiras has now chronicled an extraordinary life to date in his memoir, Walking Free, and we join our conversation recounting life in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, just ahead of Gulf War I. Already accepted into pre-med in the US, Manjit Almadiris's life was about to change dramatically.
Yeah, I lived through Saddam Hussein's era, basically, and the rise of the Ba'ath Party in the 70s and the glory of that time, and then when he entered the war with Iran and tried to get rid of the Ayatollah's regime and their biggest evil, and back then we were all like the media in Iraq was very, very, you know, a one-party media, and to us the mullahs and Iran regime was like the devil. We were told that they are the people who attacked Iraq, and which was not the true story, obviously, because Saddam did attack Iran. And anyway, he managed to fulfill the agenda of his own party as well as outside international influences to stop or hinder the movement of the Islamic Republic of Iran back then, and put halt to it with significant support from the Gulf countries. To a common Iraqi who lives in Baghdad or anywhere in Iraq, in 1988 there was a sense of victory, basically, that we put a stop to the big evil that's coming from the east, and that's what a lot of people were meant to believe in. Unfortunately, after I left, you read the news and you read about what has happened, and could be a completely different picture. So I was planning to go and do my studies in NYU, basically, and we paid the initial fees, and I was planning to do studies in like do pre-med and then decide whether I will go to medicine or dentistry, and all this was put to halt because Saddam entered Kuwait on the 2nd of August. So unfortunately I couldn't leave, and I remember very well at 6 a.m. My father listens to the news early in the early hours, and he always listened to the BBC in Iraq, though it was the government always tried to censor it, and he heard on the news that the Iraqi Republican Guards has invaded Kuwait, and he woke me up straight away and he said, "This guy is an idiot. He doesn't know what he has done, and all hell will turn loose on Iraq now, because I don't think they will leave him alone." And he was right.
Doctor, let's move forward to your early medical training in Baghdad. Post-Gulf War I, you're a young medical practitioner in a hospital. The catalyst for your leaving the country comes when, on a regular morning, a couple of buses arrive, and then what transpires?
Well, what happened, I parked my car as normal in the car park, walked to the hospital, and got to the surgical unit and theatres. That's what my posting was at that time. And then all of a sudden, we were, you know, planning to do our elective list, and I was just a first-year surgical resident over there. And three busloads of army deserters stopped and filled with army deserters, and the Republican Guards, as accompanied by the military police and the Ba'ath Party, brought these poor soldiers, and they ordered that the elective list should be cancelled, and ordered the mutilation of these people. Now, sequence of events happened before that. I think in April that year, Saddam issued a bill that 1972 born people should report to their military headquarters. And every single person in Iraq of an adult age, every male of an adult age has to be conscripted to the army. And the reason I know this bill very well, because I was born in that year. So people who are working, they get exemption, but people who are not working, they have to conscript to the army. Then after the deadline, they go and round people who failed to report. So obviously these people were rounded and brought to the hospital, and then orders were given by the Ba'ath Party and the military police that with a bill from Saddam saying that we have to surgically remove part of their ear to disfigure them, basically, and make them an example for others. So the head of the department said, I'm not doing that. This is against the Hippocrate oath that I swore. And so they took him outside in the car park and they put a bullet in his head. And then they turned to the rest of us and they said, well, now, ladies and gentlemen, we attracted your attention. Anyone share his view, please come forward. Otherwise, proceed with the surgeries. So that brought memories in my mind that my next door neighbor, for example, he was he's an army deserter. He was an army deserter, and they found him in his house. They dragged him out in his underwear in front of his woman and in front of his wife and children, and then they took him to the local headquarters of the Ba'ath Party. They interrogated him for a couple of days, and then 2 days after, Ba'ath Party cars or Land Cruisers or Utes were driving around with loudspeakers announcing that to the local people of the neighborhood to come and witness an execution. And then they basically executed him in the local Ba'ath Party headquarters with a firing squad in front of his family. His family were forced to witness that, and they were also forced to pay for the bullets that shot him, and he was not given a burial. They had to bury him in secrecy, and he was not given a funeral. He was not allowed to have a funeral, and they had to live in shame for the rest of time till Saddam was toppled. So straight away these memories came to my mind, and if I will refuse, I will face the same fate as the head of the department and my next door neighbor. Or if I obey the commands, I would dishonor my family, dishonor myself, go against every single principle I raised on. So I decided to become a coward, and I had to hide in the female toilets for 5 hours and until the operations finished. And then I escaped from Baghdad, and then my journey to Australia started.
Did you leave Baghdad and then transit through Jordan with Australia foremost in your mind, or did that develop?
No, you won't believe it, but I didn't know that I'm coming to Australia until the minute I physically saw the boat. First of all, I had to hide in a farm in western part of outside Baghdad in Anbar province, where all the troubles are happening now, until my family managed to get me money and prepare a passport for me to leave. And at the same time, they had to bribe the custom officers in the Iraq-Jordan borders to smuggle me out. And then I went to Jordan. Jordan was extremely unsafe, so I had to leave Jordan. And as an Iraqi national holding an Iraqi passport, no country on earth would give you a visa back then, and even nowadays, I think. The only place on earth that would give Iraqis visa for 14 days only was Malaysia. So I decided I would go to Malaysia, and then sequence of events happens. In Abu Dhabi, while I was in transit, I met two young men, and they looked very rough, handyman, but they were very nervous. So I started talking to them, And I asked them, what are you doing? And they said, oh, we are tourists. And I said, yeah, right, you're not tourists. You don't look touristy to me. You don't speak the language. And they were extremely nervous because when we landed in transit in Abu Dhabi, they stripped us of our passports. So and then they said, they noticed that I speak the language, I speak English, basically. And they said, well, you might be useful to us, then we might help you. So and that's when they introduced me to the people smugglers when we landed in Malaysia, basically, in KL. The smuggler told us to go to a place called Chowkit, and we met the guy, and he looked like Steve Irwin, basically. He
really?
Was blonde with exactly the same costumes that Steve Irwin used to wear. And I thought that he's Anglo-Saxon, but he turned to be a Kurdish, Iraqi Kurd, who is dealing with smuggling people. And he said, well, give me some money, give me your passport, and I'll tell you where you're going to the next destination, to your next destination. And I said to him that back then, do you expect me to give you my money and my passport and trust that you will come back? And he looked at me and he said, well, I'm a respectable smuggler. You have to trust me. And I have a reputation to protect. And, you know, I mean, and he was so confident. And I said, well, and then he looked at me again. And he said, well, do you have any other choice? I said, well, honestly, no. I have to give you the passport. So we were not aware of what was our destination. We did not know where we were going. And it was like a dark tunnel without a light at the end. He was honest with what he said to us, and he came back the next day with the passports and visas to Indonesia, and he said, this is your next destination, you go to Jakarta, and this is a phone number you call. And he was extremely accurate with his description about what we're going to face in Jakarta airport. And the other smuggler took us and he said, well, go to this part of the town, and it was a two-star or something hotel, six-story building, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. And these two people that accompanied me, or I accompanied, basically started talking, and they said, one of them said, I'm a plasterer, the other said, I'm a painter, and they said, well, this guy is a doctor. And and we were asking people about how long they've been waiting, and some of them were saying 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. I went to my room, and then 2 hours later, I got a knock on my door, and there was another smuggler wearing black and black, top and bottom. The smuggler said to me that there are people on the boat that might need medical attention. We have three pregnant women. One of them is the mullah's daughter, who is in her last trimester of pregnancy, and she need to. We need to make sure that she doesn't, or any of the other ladies, don't have any problems with during the boat because of the rough seas. So, what do you need? And I said, well, look, I need supplies. I need antiemetics. I need fluids. I need drips and things like that. And I asked him, I said, how big is the boat? He said, a brand new boat with six-cylinder Nissan engine. And I said, well, brilliant. And how many people? He said, oh, around 50. And I said, well, if that's the case, I need 100 of each. And we ended up leaving Jakarta in a bus, and there were around 50 of us. And then it was a very long journey till we got to the shores at the southern part of the island. And then we discovered that there are two buses following us with 50 or so in each one. And then we ended up 165 people on the boat, in a leaky wooden boat that's very old with a fuming engine. And we were but we were very desperate. We didn't have any other choice. And the skipper was with us on the boat, and he had this very primitive TomTom kind of navigation system as you would get in 1999. Once we reached international waters, another gray ship behind us came closer, and then a dinghy came from that vessel, parked beside us, and then the skipper said, keep going straight. In 30 hours, you would hit Christmas Island. If you miss Christmas Island, in 2 weeks, you might hit the mainland. And we were on our own, and it was a disaster. Having said that, we were not ill-informed, because we were watching the news, and I from my memory, a vessel before us sunk, and we knew that we may never get to the Australian shores. We knew that we are facing death with a very high chance that we would drown. Being a medical practitioner with reasonable education, I'd still made the decision to get on that boat because I had no other choice. And people ask, why didn't you go through the right channels? Always people ask that question. Well, unfortunately, there was no right channels. I could not see any of these channels in any of the countries that I passed through. And that's what I've tried to explain in the book is that there is no orderly departure arrangement facility in any of the countries that we go through, and that's what need to be established in order to solve part of the problem of the boat people. I mean, now the boats have been stopped by the government, and that's brilliant, but the problem hasn't been solved because there are 51 million displaced people on Earth, 800,000 of them need to be allocated, 83,000 have been allocated, and Australia's intake is around 13,000.
Doctor, I'm aware that your time is precious, so we might roll forward through to your account of the contrast between your first impressions of Australia on Christmas Island and then the detention and processing centres where, for a time, you swap between detention, jail and back to detention before returning to medicine to finish off your specialty in orthopaedic surgery. Could you fill us in a little more on your response to that passage of your life?
Christmas Island was a phosphate mine. The first impression from meeting the federal police was brilliant. We loved it. We were received very kindly by people who by the officials in the island, and I had one of the best 5 days in my life on Christmas Island. So that was a very good start. Now, the captain on the island told me, don't keep your hopes up because you will go to the mainland and it will be a different story. And he was accurate. Mm. The minute I got to the detention center, I was stripped off my name. I was given 982 as a number, and I was completely isolated from the outside environment. Now, I have three comparisons to make between the detention center and the time that I spend in prison, including maximum security jail and Broome, and the outside environment. Now, the detention center was heroic, was horrible, and it was extremely gloomy. And when I was transferred from the detention center to the prison, it was brilliant. And the prison system was like heaven for me comparatively to Curtin Detention Center. I was treated with dignity. I was called by my name, and I had proper food, and I had access to the outside environment to a certain extent. Mm. At least I had access to the media and a telephone. Inside the detention center, none of this existed. And I was 982 for 10 months. So that's the comparison that I have between a maximum security jail and a detention center. Every time I was taken to a prison comparatively to the detention center, I was very excited because, but then I was taken back to the detention center and put in a solitary confinement. In my opinion, the detention center is not cost effective. It is expensive. It is cruel, and it's unnecessary. And the indefinite detention is very cruel, and it's a massive loss for us. Every single person that I know inside the detention center was happy to go to the farms and work and pick fruit, including myself, rather than living on taxpayers. Comparatively to the outside environment, obviously, look, Australia is heaven. A lot of us don't realize how lucky we are. We are in the luckiest country on earth. Sydney is my home, and Australia is my country. And I regard myself as a very, very lucky, proud Australian. And this is the best place on earth, in my opinion, and the best place that I can raise up my kids.
Today, you're one of the world's preeminent orthopaedic surgeons, specialising in a surgery that was inspired by the Terminator movie, which you saw as a young boy in Iraq.
Well, look, we all get inspired by things. And when I was, I think it was 12 or 14, I watched The Terminator. Now, people here don't watch these kind of movies at that age, but in Iraq, the rules are different, or if there are any. That fascinated me, and I always thought, well, in the future we will be able to convert humans to machines. And and living in Iraq, a war-torn country, you see a lot of people who are disabled as a result of the war. So I saw a lot of amputees, and I always wanted to help these people. And one of my father's cousins was a leading plastic surgeon, and he was always an inspiring doctor for me. So I always dreamt of helping disabled people to get them back to as close as possible to normality. And that's why I researched and studied OCA integration, where we can combine or skeletally attach a robot to a disabled or a residuum of an amputated limb, such as an arm or a leg. And the dream came true. As I said to you, Australia is the best country on earth, and that things can be done. So we established the OCA Integration Group of Australia, and with the support of my team, we managed to make this happen. And now I am very honored that foreign countries such as the British military are sending their patients to us. There is another patient coming in 3 weeks, arriving with a surgeon to learn the technique. And I treated a British soldier before, and I was honored to be invited with them and join him when he was receiving his award from Her Majesty the Queen in Windsor Castle. And and hopefully we will continue to help people more and more. I think Australia now is the leading country, if not one of the leading countries, in OCA integration, and hopefully will continue to be.
Dr. Medeiros, it's one of the eternal frustrations of my job to encapsulate an expansive life in a few short moments. Thankfully, there's your book where people can go to learn all that I have during our conversation and much more. Thank you for walking free, and thank you also for sharing your time with us in Open House around Australia.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.